that SARS-CoV-2 is airborne. Interviews conducted by Nature with dozens of specialists on disease transmission suggest that the WHO's reluctance to accept and communicate evidence for airborne transmission was based on a series of problematic assumptions about how respiratory viruses spread. For example, even in the middle of the fast-moving epidemic, the WHO dismissed field epidemiology reports as proof of airborne transmission because the evidence was not definitive, something that is difficult to achieve quickly during an outbreak. Other criticisms are that the WHO relies on a narrow band of experts, many of whom haven't studied airborne transmission, and that it eschews a precautionary approach that could have protected countless people in the early stages of the pandemic. Critics say that inaction at the agency led to national and local health agencies around the world being similarly sluggish in addressing the airborne threat. Having shifted its position incrementally over the past 2 years, the WHO also failed to adequately communicate its changing position, they say. As a result, it didn't emphasize early enough and clearly enough the importance of ventilation and indoor masking, key measures that can prevent airborne spread of the virus. Lydia Morvasa, an aerosol scientist at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, spearheaded several efforts to convince the WHO and other health agencies of the airborne threat. She says that airborne transmission was so obvious as far back as February 2020, and that omitting it from official guidelines was disastrous. Resolving this debate about how to assess the transmission of respiratory viruses matters, say researchers, because a more deadly variant of SARS-CoV-2 could emerge at any time, and new respiratory viruses will almost certainly plague humanity at some point. It's not clear whether the WHO and the world will be ready.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the level higher than the jurisprudential fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, we know that there are different classifications of every ibadah that we do. When it comes to fasting, there are three different levels that we're discussing. The first one is the jurisprudential fasting, which is the bare minimum, the lowest level of 1. keeping a valid fast. Now, today we want to discuss the next level, which is a level higher than the jurisprudential fasting. Because really, honestly, this is what we should be doing in our lives. We should be moving from A to B to C to D, right? From step 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, the level 1, 2, 3, 4. So same thing with the fasting, right? We should be moving up the ladder. A faster at this level is expected to think why he or she is told to refrain from eating and drinking, which are essential nutrition for his or her body. You know, this thought should occupy them, that why am I supposed to not do certain things in this blessed month, and why have I been asked not to perform those actions which otherwise in rest of the months are okay to perform. You know, this is a thought which actually would be a good start for, especially for the youth. Could it be that by refraining from consuming the essentials, I learn to more easily refrain from unnecessary and even harmful inputs to my body and soul? Now, this could be another good question and a rhetoric answer, you would say, that, you know, a person observing this higher level of fast, you know, fulfilling the requirements of that other basic level that we discussed previously, you know, this person is now trying to fathom and understand the hikmah and the wisdom behind the fasting, okay? And this is that one step further. And we'll continue discussing this after a short break. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing a higher level of fasting when compared to the jurisprudential level, which is the basic lowest level. Now, once this person who's fasting successfully finishes a month of Sharia fasting, which is the jurisprudential fasting, by refraining from soft drinks, let's say, and halal food, and even finds him or herself healthier than before, the faster should find it easier by far to avoid intoxicants or haram foods, which are even harmful for his or her body and does not really require. You know, it's not something that our body asks for. There are so many of those things that we consume day in, day out, where we know that they are not the requirement, the natural requirement of our body. So what the blessed month of Ramadan does is to this fasting person, it makes them realize that it's not like they're dependent on these extra things that they're consuming or performing, okay? Once a faster is aware of such fasts, they will be ready to enter the higher level of fasting, which can be called the fasting of al-tariqat, right? So this is a level which is the next level to the jurisprudential fasting, you know, where you are thinking about the philosophy of fasting, where you're trying to figure out and fathom the requirements and why you've been asked to refrain from certain things. And it's a whole different level. If you can sense it intellectually and using your intellect, you would see that, okay, there's something more to it. It's not just the will of Allah to keep me hungry and thirsty. No, Allah wills something more from this act of fasting. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Just days ago, Israeli occupation forces attacked Al-Quds' Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers on one of the holiest days in the Islamic calendar. Now, in a fresh bout of violence, Israeli forces have again targeted Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Dozens of Israeli military forces have stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinian worshippers into the Flashpoint holy site to secure the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. This is while the day before, the settlers entered the compound amid a heavy military deployment of Israeli soldiers to mark the Passover holiday and perform their own prayers. this year, the Jewish religious occasion coincides with the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan at a time when thousands of Muslims, predominantly Palestinians, usually stay at the holy site for worship, a rare convergence that will drive unusually high numbers of Jewish, Muslim, and Christian worshippers to the old city of Al-Quds. Far-right Jewish groups have even called for raids of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the Jewish Passover holiday and the offering of animal sacrifices in its courtyards, which has not occurred since ancient times. Sacred to Muslims and revered by Jews, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site, has long been a flashpoint in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And it's really pushing the Palestinians out of Jerusalem. It's trying to Judaize the city of Jerusalem. And we saw them attacking completely innocent people, you know, old people, women, children. So it's not really about security for Jewish worshippers.
Palestinians in the occupied territories have reacted to the raids by the Israeli security forces by going out to the streets in support of the worshippers. Israel, meanwhile, is trying to paint a different narrative. The Western-backed media is hard at work painting the Palestinians as the aggressors, even calling the worshippers rioters and terrorists. Israel says its so-called security operation is an effort to protect freedom of worship from violent rioters desecrating the site and endangering the public, but it has a tough task since scores of videos show the opposite to be the case. Palestinians are angry on a wide variety of fronts. They are suffering immensely due to the Israeli occupation. Additionally, they are amazed at the international community's indifference to the Palestinian suffering amid the Ukraine crisis. Furthermore, the paralysis of the Palestinian leadership has added salt to their wounds, who seems unable to do anything. The resistance group Hamas, however, has described the crisis as the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes, attempts to Judaize Al-Quds and to perform sacrifices in the Al-Aqsa Mosque to build its so-called temple during what they call Passover. The Gaza Strip, meanwhile, is at risk of another Israeli onslaught. Israeli tanks and armored vehicles have made an incursion into northern Gaza Strip, raising the possibility of another war.
Governments around the world need to stop supporting the Israeli aggressions against the Palestinians. And I can say myself, as a rabbi and as a Jewish person, the Jewish communities around the world have to stop supporting the Israeli aggression against the Palestinians.
A similar Israeli assault on Al-Aqsa during Ramadan last year sparked a military confrontation between resistance factions in Gaza, led by Hamas and Israel. Hamas has said this year Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa and its worshippers is a declaration of war. And sure enough, early on Tuesday, the Gaza Strip came under Israeli assault, reportedly after rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. This is a sure sign that another war may be in the making.
Scuffles and unrest were reported in several spots across Sweden. Fierce clashes have broken out between police and protesters during demonstrations against a far-right group's intention to burn the Holy Quran. Violent skirmishes erupted between supporters of the Strom Curse party and the opponents of the blasphemous plan. Clashes and demonstrations have been held in a couple of cities. Over a dozen police officers have also been injured since the unrest started. Meanwhile, police has backed the hardline party's plan, saying it would not revoke permission for a demonstration organized by the party, because this free speech threshold for doing that is very high in Sweden. That's why there have been reported clashes in locations that the hardline party either had planned or had demonstrations. Also, Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson came out in support of the far-right group, making remarks that have been deemed provocative. She said in Sweden people are allowed to express their opinions whether they are in good or bad taste. That is part of our democracy. These remarks only fanned the fire of unrest across the country and drew condemnations from the Muslim world, like from Iran. Iran summoned the Swedish envoy and condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying the blasphemy was committed under the protection of the Swedish police. Tehran said it would hold the Swedish government as accountable and expects an immediate reaction from Stockholm against the perpetrator, as well as practical measures to prevent such incidents. On Thursday, the Hardline Party held a rally in a heavily Muslim-populated area in Sweden. At the demonstration, the party leader burned a copy of the Holy Quran, ignoring objections from onlookers. Counter-protests broke out with demonstrators setting fire to security vehicles after police ignored calls to stop the far-right demonstration. Strom Kurs is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances. Anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise across Europe in recent years in the wake of terrorist attacks in the continent, carried out mostly by Daesh sympathizers or the terrorist group's members who returned home following the group's defeat in Iraq and Syria. Muslim leaders in Europe and around the world have repeatedly condemned the terrorist attacks. Moreover, the rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have also exacerbated the status of religious minorities in Europe. Also, different sorts of bans on hijab in countries like Germany and France, as well as closure of mosques and religious centers, have further pressured the Muslim community in those countries. Add to it the discrimination in recruitment and provision of job opportunities, harassment at workplace, and hate speech. Also, hate crimes against Muslims are rife in Europe. While the Muslim communities represent an indispensable minority of more than 25 million people, in the 27 European Union member states, a 2018 poll found that within the bloc, an average 37% of the population admits to having unfavorable views of Muslims. The mainstream Western media usually give coverage to Muslim matters through the prism of negative and counterproductive stereotypes. This biased coverage further promotes unreal stereotypes. In addition, European leaders have either been unsuccessful or reluctant in providing a convincing counter-narrative to Islamophobia. The UK has announced a controversial deal with Rwanda to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers to the East African country. The British government claims this scheme, which is worth $156 million, would have stopped smugglers from sending thousands of desperate migrants on dangerous journeys across the English Channel every year. Over 28,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the English Channel in 2021. That's three times higher than the year before. In November last year, 27 people died while trying to reach the UK when their boat sank in the worst disaster to occur on the Channel. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hailed the deal with Kigali, saying the East African country with a sketchy human rights record is one of the safest countries in the world, globally recognized for its record of welcoming and integrating migrants. Rwanda already hosts some 140,000 refugees in six refugee camps. However, rights groups and refugee organizations swiftly slammed what they called a cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial plan. They also questioned both its costs to British taxpayers and its effect on migration. According to a recent poll, 60% of the British public is dissatisfied with the Johnson government's migration policy. The UN's refugee agency has also voiced opposition, saying people fleeing persecution should not be treated like commodities. The world body stated that such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Others have criticized Rwanda's human rights record, accusing the government of torturing, intimidating, and assassinating their political opponents, and persecuting marginalized people. Johnson said the deal will become a new international standard in handling migration, but human rights groups have warned that the plan could set a dangerous trend for other Western countries to adopt their offshore asylum schemes.
Well, Britain has a good history of trading in human beings. As you know, the whole sort of movement of Africans to North America, Britain was a leading player in shipping slaves from Africa to North America and to Caribbean islands. So Britain has a track record of trading in human beings. So one could, if you like, describe it in that manner. But I think the evil aspect of what's really happening in 2022, that may have happened 200 years ago, and when later on slavery was banned. But the reality is that perhaps we are living in a new epoch of slavery at this time.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has vowed to curb the English Channel crossings. However, there has been a drastic increase in the number of people arriving on British shores on small boats in recent years. The government passed a Nationality and Borders Bill that would make it a criminal offence to enter the UK illegally, and it would introduce life sentences for people smugglers. But the UN's refugee agency criticized the bill, saying it would penalize most refugees seeking asylum in the country and would create an asylum model that undermines established international refugee protection rules and practices. Meanwhile, the refugee deal with Rwanda comes as more Ukrainians arrive in the UK through different visa programs that the Johnson government has rolled out in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. Over 55,000 visas have been issued to refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine so far. This clearly shows a contradiction between the proposed policy and the British government's attitude toward Ukrainian refugees.
The reality is that the British government is acting in a very racist manner as well. They might say that, okay, it was sort of media correspondence who depicted the European the Ukrainian refugees in that manner. But the reality is that the implementation of this policy perhaps smacks of what I call racism, clear and without any sort of dilution to it.
Unlike what the British government claims, those seeking to cross the English Channel and land on British soil are not illegal economic migrants, but are mainly those who have escaped bloodshed, war and terror. They are people fleeing oppression and violence from Afghanistan, West Asia or even Europe. They are exercising their right under the UN Refugee Convention, which the UK was a founding signatory of, to seek asylum in a country of their choosing. And let's not forget that they are no different from Ukrainian refugees.
Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and attacked the Palestinian worshippers there. The raid began at dawn on Friday when Israeli forces entered the compound through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, throwing stun grenades and shooting rubber bullets at the crowd indiscriminately. 400 Palestinians were arrested. Media reports said the Israeli forces also attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and beat a number of them. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that 152 fasting Palestinians had been transferred to hospitals in the occupied Al-Quds for injuries as a result of the raid. Following the Friday prayers, people held rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
They want it for themselves. They want the Palestinians gone. They want Islam to be gone from Palestine and Christianity too, everything except Judaism. So really, they don't mind having this as a flashpoint for them, as a center of dispute. They want this dispute to go on until they win. That's what they're looking for. And every time they bring settlers there to cause trouble, it's part of what they see as a continuing war for their control of the land. That's what this is about.
The regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression across the Palestinian territories since the beginning of Ramadan, as a result of which Palestinians put up a stronger resistance to counter the aggression. The events unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of clashes between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank last year that led to an 11-day war between the resistance groups in Gaza and Israel. Over 250 Palestinians were killed in the war, many of them were women and children. Observers now believe that more confrontations are imminent. As the pressure mounts, Palestinians have stepped up their retaliatory operations against the Israelis. Over the past 3 weeks, Palestinians have carried out 4 such retaliatory operations, killing over a dozen Israelis. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given the regime's forces a free hand to crack down on Palestinians. He has also called on Israeli civilians with gun licenses to carry weapons in public.
They can find ways to make the Israeli occupation painful. And already, actually, quite a few Israelis over the last decade have emigrated elsewhere. You have Israeli immigration into Europe and the United States and to Australia. Possibly as many as 1 million Israelis have done that. If the Palestinians can make it painful enough for the Israelis might just disappear.
When some Arab states announce a normalization of ties with Israel, they claim that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering. In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK, and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom, alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hawza.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well, and I'm studying in Qom as well, in the Sisters Hawza. And my field of study is Fiqh and Usul. Fiqh and Usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence.
Very great. Now, we see people, they fast, they pray, they do too much of ibadat, so, which are the things they do to get closer to God. But still, Muslim people have issues in their societies. Still, there are people who lie. Still, there are people who fight with each other. Still, there are people who do plenty of wrong things. Now, how do you justify that, sister?
We have two devils. You have the outer devil, and then we have the inner devil. The inner devil is that soul that we have not corrected within ourselves. We still have these evil traits within ourselves that we've never bothered to correct, or maybe we did not succeed in correcting them. And therefore, when the month of Ramadan comes, it's still there, because the month of Rajab and Sha'ban are there to help us correct ourselves. But if we do not take advantage of these situations, of these times, and just focus on our day-to-day lives without focusing on correcting our souls, we're never going to be able to correct ourselves or correct our communities. Because God does not change the condition of a people unless they change it themselves.
Exactly.
So that's the first point. The second point comes down to the month of Ramadan is an opportunity for us. And as we said, we have the free will, whether we use it or not. It comes down to how we use the position, the banquet that Allah has spread for us. How do we use it? Because Shaitan might be locked up, but our inner devil is still there, ready to strike mm-hmm. whenever we...
We still have free will.
We still have free will, and we also have the inner devil that we are using on our free will to, yes. to inflict trouble on others.
We have to overcome that.
We have to overcome that, yes.
Exactly. So now, brother, you see, it's not just about the holy month. As Muslim people, we see that we have plenty of this heritage that tells us, do not do this, don't do that, and go for these good things, go for good deeds, be in hurry for doing those good deeds. What happens to a Muslim that goes outside the line? You know what I mean? Mm. We do all those good things, but that does not change a lot about us. How is it?
Comes back to what the sister said.
And I mean, the fasting turns out to be just not eating or not drinking.
Yeah, I mean, Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra has a really beautiful hadith on this. And she says, what is wrong with the person who fasts with their stomachs, but mm-hmm. not with their eyes, with their hands, with their heart, with the other parts of themselves? When you're fasting, the hadith actually teach us, the riwayat, the narrations teach us, mm-hmm. that fasting is not just a physical action, it is actually something which should be done with all of our essence and being.
Exactly. The entire being of ourselves has to go through this process.
Yeah. I mean, if you're fasting with your stomach, but you're not fasting with your eyes, what does mm-hmm. fasting of the eyes mean? It means that you're going to refrain from looking at those things which are haram for you to look at.
Exactly.
Fasting of the hands, you're going to stop yourself from taking that which does not belong to you. Fasting of the feet, you're not going to walk towards that which Allah would be displeased by. So all of these play a role in fasting itself.
So what happens to me that I do the fasting and yet I lie?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to me? What are the reasons? I want to know the reasons behind that.
Well, why would we lie in any place? Lying is a huge sin.
No, right? You know, because mm-hmm. when we are fasting, we're going through a terrible. You know, I'm getting weaker, I don't eat, I don't drink.
Yeah,
all these terribles
grouchy.
I take mm. and still, I do horrible things.
I think a lot of it would come down to sincerity, mm-hmm. just like Sister Siddiqa mentioned. If we're not sincerely doing it for the sake of Allah, one of the beautiful things about the month of Ramadan is it allows the monster to be revealed within us. That's what it really does.
Yeah.
When you're hungry, you're tired, that monster within will come out.
Exactly.
You know, we'll suddenly lash out, we'll get angry, and then we'll realize, mm-hmm. I have this weakness. So part of the process is actually identifying the weaknesses that exist so that we're able to correct those things within us.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Give us some recommendations, some advices on how to be sincere as well as fasting.
First, for every action that we do, have an intention. Who am I really doing it for? And this comes down to digging very deep within the soul. There might be people who fast the mustahab fasts before the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it actually becomes very clearer, because in the month of Ramadan, it is wajib to fast. It is obligatory to fast. One doesn't really have much of a choice there, unless, of course, different other laws apply to them, which allow them to refrain from fasting. For every action that we do, when we start making an intention or understanding who we're doing it for, it starts to become clearer for us where our loyalty lies. Does it lie with Allah, or does it lie with the fame and the respect that we get from other people?
So at first, we have to notice the intention.
You know, in the month of Ramadan, in some countries, there's iftar for the whole 30 nights,
mm-hmm.
sitting with other people, serving in the different Husayniyas, in the different mosques.
Yes, they come together.
Who am I serving other people with food for? Mm-hmm. Is it for Allah, or is it so that I can get a bit more fame? Am I going to feed another person so that I can be praised for my charitable acts, or am I going to do it solely
exactly.
for the sake of Allah?
They call him or her a very generous person.
Yes, yeah, so it comes down to digging very deep within the soul. And that's the first step. And once that step is done, then we can see where our vices lie, where our problems are.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can start to correct ourselves. Because if I don't know where my problems are or what issues I have within my soul, I'm never going to be able to correct them.
So the intention and considering the satisfaction of God. Now, aside from that, brother, I would like you to tell us how to chain the monster inside.
Chaining the monster inside.
Because I know some people, and I've heard about it, that they do some wrong things during the year, but when it comes to the holy month, they stop doing that. Now, it's bad. I know it's a bad habit, but still they have a respect for that month.
Even that is, you know, it's better than nothing. Yeah.
Exactly.
The idea
it's an improvement.
That, yeah, the improvements that we make in the month of Ramadan, we're supposed to continue them. But the point I was making was that, look, sister, what are you? What are you composed of? You, as a person, what constitutes you? So if we go to the subject of akhlaq itself, the mystics talk about four faculties which actually create us, right? The first is intellect. The second is wahm, or the imagination. The third is ghadab, or anger. And the fourth is shahwa, desire, right? These four faculties are what constitute a human being. Now, when you think of intellect, you understand that this is a good thing, right? And the intellect is supposed to be in charge of the other three faculties, right?
Yes.
But then when you think of the other ones, imagination, you think of anger, you think of shahwa, desire, you think that they're really bad things. Why would Allah inherently create something evil within us that we have to chain up? That's not the idea of Islam. Rather, we're supposed to give direction to the other faculties. If the intellect is in charge of the other faculties within us, it will always direct the other faculties to doing those good things. For example, imagination, right? If you try and chain the imagination, it's not going to work. Imam Khomeini describes it as almost like a bird, which is jumping from one branch to another. It's always jumping. It's a fleeting imagination. They'll go into fantasies.
You must
start
give it
thinking
a direction.
About things which are haram. The imagination can be used for extraordinary things.
Exactly.
Imagining Jannah. The waham is described as the eyes of the heart. Things that you haven't seen, you haven't witnessed, and yet you're supposed to bring iman on them. The angels. Have you ever seen an angel? Maybe you have. But do you really know what they look like? No. You have to use the imagination to reach those things. The same with hell and the same with barzakh and the afterlife general. Okay, what about anger? Are you supposed to chain the anger and never let it out? No. As a Muslim, you're supposed to let anger out in a controlled manner against injustice, for example, whatever shape and form that injustice takes. Your boss is trampling all over you. I'm going to chain my anger. I'm never going to get angry. And you convince yourself that that's the right thing to do. No, it's not. If injustice is taking place, you're supposed to express anger in a controlled manner. If you don't, then those people are going to continue to commit injustice against you and against other people, right? And the same with shahwa, desire. If you have no desire, you're not going to open your fast at the end of the day, and you are going to die from starvation.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes, that's
true. Shahwa, we think about it in a completely negative way. Actually, it's something that we are inbuilt with, which helps us to nourish ourselves. The problem occurs when the intellect is not on top of it.
It goes out of control.
It goes out of control. Now you've just become obese. Now you've just become addicted to a video game, which you're supposed to enjoy. Now you're not even enjoying it. You're just scrolling on your phone, getting those dopamine shots over and over and over again. You're not even enjoying it anymore. Hello? You're not even enjoying it. You're just addicted.
Exactly. Right? We're just addicted. So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So we were discussing how to be looking good inside and outside.
Allah has actually given us a roadmap to enjoy life. There was a celebrity, right? Working out is really difficult, right? When you go to exercise and you're lifting those weights, you hate it.
It is
very difficult.
You actually
hate it, right?
Yes.
It's horrible. I saw this celebrity in the West. I don't want to mention his name, but he said, when I push weights, he's a bodybuilder. When I push weights, I get the most enjoyment more than anything else in the world.
Though it is very difficult.
We were supposed to train ourselves, train our shahwa, our desire, to enjoy those things which Allah's pleasure is to be found. And this is how the mystics actually enjoy the salah. They enjoy it. Yeah. They love praying.
So they grow a desire in themselves in which this process of purification and growing turns out to be an interesting thing.
It's a beautiful thing. It's something that we enjoy. What's the opposite of desire? Disgust, right? Mm-hmm. Desire attracts you.
Yes.
Disgust, you know, it repels you. The Ahlul Bayt, when they were questioned, how can you be ma'asum? How can you avoid all sins? They pointed to something disgusting, a carcass which had maggots and flies all over it. And they said, would you eat this? And the guy said, hell no, that's disgusting. Mm-hmm. He said, sins appear like this to us.
They see the true nature of those things.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when we allow the intellect to actually govern the shahwa, we'll start to see things in the way that Allah wants us to see them. Right. And so sins will appear disgusting to
us. Exactly.
And evil deeds, they'll appear disgusting to us. But good deeds, those things which Allah's pleasure is in, we'll start to see those things as enjoyable and we'll be entertained and love them.
So we have to nurture ourselves and work on ourselves more and more and then have a direction in our path.
Exactly. So coming back to the idea of chaining the monster within, that's not the outlook of Islam. We're not supposed to chain it per se. Mm-hmm. And this makes it appear very difficult and something very strenuous.
Yes.
And something that, you know,
sentence has a very hard connotation.
No.
You feel like it's very huge and massive.
As Muslims, Islam is actually teaching us to be like water. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's just about directing the water
exactly.
in the right way.
Controlling the way.
But if you try and build a dam and stop the water from flowing, you'll become dry. You'll become dead. And that's why there's so many people who embark on what apparently seems to be the spiritual journey. When you talk to them, though, they appear like dead people. Right. They're just like planks of wood.
Exactly.
Like, man, where is your personality? Mm-hmm. Where is you never get angry? What do you mean you never get angry?
Well, perhaps you're not alive.
You never have desire?
Yes.
Ahlul Bayt had desire. Ahlul Bayt had anger.
The thing is to control them. The thing is to give them direction. If we're fasting, we do that for the intention that God starts to be satisfied with us. With this intention comes the responsibility to control our desires and go in a way that will lead us to a good destination. This was all the time we had for today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
In the limelight.
As everyday Americans continue to struggle during the ongoing pandemic, taxes on the rich remain shamefully low and billionaires have seen their wealth skyrocket. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Stain on Democracy. Tax Day study shows U.S. billionaires now own $4.7 trillion. Here's more. An analysis released recently to mark Tax Day in the United States shows that the country's 735 billionaires have seen their collective wealth soar by 62% over the past 2 years, while worker earnings have grown just 10%. Modest gains eaten away by rising costs of food, housing, and other necessities. According to new calculations by Oxfam America, U.S. billionaires now own a combined $4.7 trillion in wealth, much of which goes completely untaxed. As ProPublica recently found in an examination of data from the Internal Revenue Service, an agency that disproportionately targets the poor, the 25 richest people in the U.S. paid a true tax rate of just 3.4% from 2014 to 2018. The billionaire wealth explosion in this country comes at a time of historic inflation hitting working families, compounded by the expiration of critical social safety nets put in place at the start of the pandemic to protect America's most vulnerable. Said Gina Cummings, Vice President of Advocacy Alliances and Policy at Oxfam America. Cummings added, "The impact on real people is devastating, leading countless families to slip into poverty. The ongoing failure of our nation's leaders to implement a more equitable tax system is a stain on democracy." Oxfam's new analysis estimates that a series of tax proposals that have been introduced in Congress but have yet to pass would bring in $252 billion in additional federal revenue each year. The version of President Joe Biden's Build Back Better agenda that the House passed in November would cost just $175 billion per year over the next decade. That legislation, which includes clean energy investments and an extension of the poverty-slashing child tax credit boost, is effectively dead in the Senate due to opposition of every Republican, as well as Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Both Manchin and Sinema have pushed back on Democrats' efforts to hike taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Oxfam notes that Senator Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax proposal would yield $113 billion in federal revenue just from billionaires in 2022, enough to fund an extension of the lapsed child tax credit boost, affordable child care, and soon-to-expire free school lunch waivers. Senator Ron Wyden's plan to tax billionaires' unrealized capital gains, meanwhile, would raise $56 billion a year on average. That new revenue, according to Oxfam, would more than cover paid sick leave, that is $10 billion, family medical leave, $20 billion, as well as affordable child care to allow more mothers and caregivers to return to work by absorbing the crushing cost of care for young families, that is about $24 billion. While the pandemic grinds on, it is shocking to realize and accept that three-quarters of low-wage workers do not have access to paid sick leave, said Cummings. It needs to be said that a vastly disproportionate share of these workers are women and people of color, making this a civil rights issue. This is not just morally unacceptable. It's dangerous for everyone. We can fix this with a small tax on those who have billions to spare. The aid group noted that another $63 billion could be raised by implementing a global minimum tax on multinational corporations, a proposal that the Biden administration and the leaders of more than 130 other countries have backed. But huge obstacles remain in the way of final approval of the tax, given that the legislatures of individual nations have to approve it. Oxfam found that the $63 billion a year in corporate tax revenue could allow the U.S. to invest in climate finance, including tax credits for clean energy, $11.4 billion, and cutting carbon emissions, with tax credits for consumers and companies, that is $32 billion, and fund critical public health needs, including funding global COVID health needs, that is about $5 billion. Covering the uninsured for COVID vaccines and testing, about $1.5 billion. Expanding Medicare for hearing, $8.9 billion, and closing the Medicaid gap, $6 billion. We reject the narrative that this country cannot afford to invest in a better world, protect the planet, feed hungry children, ensure childcare costs, do not wipe out a family's earnings, guarantee that hourly workers receive paid leave for illness or the birth of a child, Cummings said recently. The American people have been told a lie, Cummings continued, adding they are paying their fair share to keep this country running. It's time for our nation's billionaires and giant corporations to contribute their fair share of taxes to support the every people who have provided the labor that has allowed them to enjoy record profits and excess wealth. Oxfam America is planning to join activists from Americans for Tax Fairness, Move On, and Daily Cause in delivering petition signatures from more than 500,000 U.S. taxpayers expressing opposition to the glaring inequities of the U.S. tax system. As everyday Americans continue to struggle during the ongoing pandemic, taxes on the rich remain shamefully low, and billionaires have seen their wealth skyrocket, Caroline Fittler, communications director for Daily Cause, said in a statement, adding, "We call on Congress and President Biden to hold billionaires and wealthy accountable."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, we have been discussing about Mahdawiyat, Imam Mahdi, in this session. We have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So Dr. Karimi, we had been discussing in previous session that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala faraja is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and even if he is from the lineage of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, you proved that how beautifully proving the point that lineage is not only from fathers, lineage can be also from mothers, not stretching on the senseless, useless points, not stretching on the narrations that have incomplete chain, not stressing on the narrations that have incomplete content, like what a Wahhabi scholar did
in proving the point that Imam Mahdi ajallah ta'ala faraja belongs to the lineage of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. Well, we came up with a number of narrations in previous sessions and we proved that, and we came up with one authentic narration from Shia schools as well. And we proved that Imam Mahdi ajallah ta'ala faraja is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now in today's session, I would want to ask you very, very interesting thing about the disappearance and reappearance of Imam. We have some sources saying that Imam Mahdi ajallah ta'ala farajahum, he disappeared from the basement. Where will he reappear? Because there are some narrations that say that he will reappear in Kaaba.
First of all, let me talk about what these basement or
what we call a